Chapter 13. Locastre. Full stop. End of the line. We arrived at Locastre over an hour behind schedule. Unseasonal blizzards had swept up from the east into the Utes, and the express had been forced to reduce speed to a crawl. On steep gradients through the passes, there was a danger of backslip, and we could feel the frequent jerks as the car bogies hunted over the ice-caked rails. There was a 10-minute stop on a straight section on the west of Ute Major, as the train's engineer gangs got out and winched the locomotive's nose-plow into place. The blizzard was around us then, and everything outside the windows was a colourless swirl. I went down to the end of the car and peered out through the van windows. Black blobs were moving in the white haze, some lit by fizzling flares of green and red. I felt several jolts and metallic clunks shiver through the deck beneath me. The intercar tannoy softly informed us that we would be on our way soon, reassured us that the weather was no hazard, and soothed us with the news that complimentary hot punch was now being served in the dining salon. Unnecessarily muffled in furs or expensive mountain wear, other passengers came to peer out of the mush-flecked ports, grumbling and what-ifing. I returned to the cabin I shared with Amos, locked the doors, and sat down with him. I ran through my theory.
Pontius Glaur,
his old lips spat the name.
Pontius Glaur.
It fits, doesn't it?
From what you tell me, Gregor. Though, of course, I know little of what passed between you and that monster on Kinchair.
We had first tackled the villainy of Pontius Glaur and his poisonous brood right there on Gudrun back in 240, an age ago, as it seemed. At the time, Glaur himself, a notorious heretic, had been dead for 2 centuries, his obscene activities curtailed by Inquisitor Angevin. But Glaur's intellect and engrammed personality had been preserved in a sympathetic crystal by his noble family. We thwarted the attempts of House Glaur to restore him to corporeal life, and afterwards I had the crystal placed for safekeeping with my old ally, Magos Geared Bure of the Adeptus Mechanicus. A century later, in 340, I had revisited Bure's remote fastness on the mining world Kinchair during the Quixos affair, in order to obtain arcane information concerning demon hosts from his prisoner. Without Pontius Glaur's dark advice, I would never have been able to vanquish Quixos or his slaved demons, Profanity and Cherubael. But I had been forced to deal with Glaur. Make it worth his while. The lure I dangled was that in return for his help, I would commission Bure to manufacture a body for him to inhabit. And because I was an honourable man, I kept my word, believing that even if Glaur was given mobility, he would never escape Geared Bure's clutches. It seemed I had been wrong about that. During those private interviews on Kinchair, Glaur had confessed to me the event that had driven him, the accomplished scion of one of Gudrun's most respected noble houses, into the worship of the warp. It had happened on Quenthus 8 in 019. Glaur had been visiting the Quenthi amphitheatres, purchasing gladiators for his pit-fighting hobby. Even before his fall, he was a cruel man. He bought one brute, a warrior from a remote feral world. Moria, I seem to recall. Anxious to please his new master, the warrior had given Glaur his torque. It was an ancestral relic from the feral world, and neither the warrior nor Glaur realized it was tainted with the foulest chaos. Glaur had put it on, and immediately had fallen into its clutches. That one simple act had sealed his fate, and transformed him into the idolatrous fiend who had plagued the Helican subsector for nearly 2 decades. I gave Amos the gist of this.
The matter seems to fit together. You believe, I take it, that Pontius Glaur has escaped from his prison on Kinchair, built up his forces, and is now targeting you for revenge?
Revenge? No. Well, indirectly, perhaps. He certainly would want to have his revenge on me, but the scale of his attack, the effort, the comprehensive scope, every element of my operation, and Inchibel, too. Amos shrugged.
Inchibel was with us at Kinchair.
That's my point. Pontius is trying to destroy everyone who might know he exists. Most of the Imperium believes he is long dead. We pose a threat to him just by knowing about him. I could tell Amos had something on his mind that he didn't want to say. Amos?
Nothing, Gregor.
Old friend? He shook his head. Say it. Pontius Glore's existence is only a secret because I never informed the Ordos that he was still sentient. Because I never delivered his engram sphere into the custody of the Ordo Hereticus, as I should have. And he's only free now because I had a body built for him.
No.
He got to his feet and squinted out of the car window, trying to see something, anything, in the blizzard.
We've had this conversation before, or at least one like it. About Cherubael.
He turned to look at me. He was so very old.
You are an inquisitor of the glorious Imperium of Mankind. You are dedicated to the destruction of evil in any facet of its three classic forms. Xenos, Malleus, Hereticus. You face unimaginable hazards. Yours is the most arduous task undertaken by any Imperial servant. You must use every weapon at your disposal to protect our culture, even the arsenal of the enemy. And you know full well that sometimes such uses have consequences. We may now regret your actions with Pontius Claw, but without those, Quixos would not have been brought down. We can play the if-only game all day. The simple truth is that victory comes at a price, and we are paying that price now. The true measure of your character is what you do about it.
I correct my mistakes. I bring down Pontius Glore.
I have no doubt of that.
Thank you, Amos. He sat down again.
This Tare woman, how does she fit in?
I showed him the census record. The Tares were a low-caste family on Gudrun during Glore's organic lifetime. Then the line stops abruptly, but reappears on Quenthus. I think the Tares, or at least a Tare, were amongst Glore's retinue, and he took them to Quenthus. I need you to look into that at Locastra.
Locastra? But we're only going to be stopping there for 45 minutes.
I gestured to the window. It'll probably be longer given the weather, but you'll have to move fast. I'm going to use the time to access the Aegis account. The handle of the lock-connecting door ratcheted back and forth.
Gregor.
It was Crezia.
What are you doing locked in there?
She called through the door. Just discussing things with Amos.
They're serving hot punch in the salon. I thought we might mingle.
In a minute, I called out in reply. There was a lurch, and the train started to move again. I looked at Amos. The things we've spoken about. They don't go any further. Not yet. Crezia doesn't need to know. Neither does Alina come to that.
My lips are sealed, he said.
We came out of the blizzard and down a comfortable gradient into Locastra. It was nearly midday. The bad weather lurked like a grey wall behind us, veiling the utes, but reports suggested it was moving into the valley. At Locastra, the porters announced a 90-minute stop. I told Alina to make sure the express didn't leave until Amos and I were safely back. Locastra occupies a cleft valley, gouged by glaciers. The old buildings are dark grey. Granite stands in for the traditional Gudrun ouzlite used in the lowlands, and the altitude and climate is such that pressurized, heated tunnels of armor glass sheath the streets. I hired a servitor litter and had it scurry me through the warm, damp street tunnels, as ominous squalls of snow peppered the transparent roof above. Outside the office of the Astropathic Guild, I told it to wait and left my credit bar locked into its fare meter as good faith. It settled low on its spider-limbed chassis, venting steam from its hydraulics. There was a message from Nail waiting for me in the Aegis account. He had made good time and was already in New Givet. Passage off-world had been arranged with a freighter called the Caucus. He was eager to see me. Nail's communique was in glossier, and I phrased my reply the same way. Weather permitting, we would be in New Givet in 2 days. On arrival, I would arrange a meeting with him.
"Is that all, sir?"
asked the adept attending me. I remembered Crezia's comments over dinner about Nail being trustworthy. I added another line, suggesting that the situation reminded me of the tight spot we'd been in on Ichan years before, facing Beldame Sadia. "Send it, please," I said. Up at the station, the express sounded its horn. The express rumbled up into the central Athens, chased by the weather. Despite the fact that we were now scaling some of the steepest and longest gradients in the route, the locomotive was running at full power, trying to outpace the snows for as long as it could. The main range of the Atens, through which we now travelled, included the greatest mountains on Gudrun, Skarno, Dorpalin, the Heldegay, Vespa, Mount Atina. Each one dwarfed the peaks like Mons Fulco that we had encountered earlier. They seemed as dark and cyclopean as tilted continents. They were also beautiful. Peerless tracks of blue-white ice, unblemished leagues of snow, sharp sunshine that almost twinkled like starlight in a vacuum. Until, before nightfall, it all vanished. Freezing fog and vapour descended like a stage curtain, sealing out the light and dropping visibility to a few dozen metres. Then snow began to flutter again, and our speed decreased. The weather had caught up with us.
Gregor, I had been watching the snowstorm, come in here.
Krezia beckoned me through the connecting door. Medea was awake. The cyber skulls hovered back to give me room as I sat down beside her cot. She looked tired and drawn, faded almost. But her eyes were half open, and she managed a thin smile as she saw me.
Everything's okay. You're in safe hands.
Her mouth moved, but no sound came out.
Don't try to speak, Krezia whispered.
I saw curiosity in Medea's eyes as she focused on Krezia.
This is Dr. Bershilde, a good friend.
She saved your life.
Long.
What?
How long been sleep?
The best part of a week. You were wounded in the back.
Ribs sore.
That will pass, said Krezia.
They get us.
No, they didn't get us, I said. And they're not going to get us, either. Shrouded by the bitter blizzards and maintaining no more than 60 kilometres an hour, we journeyed on across the roof of the world. I ventured out into the public areas and even to the salon a few times and found that diverting entertainments had been laid on. Buffet meals, music, card schools, a regicide tournament, screenings of popular hololithic extravaganzas. Uniformed transcontinental personnel were out in force, keeping everybody happy and volubly disseminating the notion that being caught in an Atenate ice storm was all part of the romance of the famous rail line, and not a potentially lethal misfortune. If the locomotive derailed, or the power plant malfunctioned, and the train became stranded in the midst of a blizzard that lasted more than a couple of days, we'd freeze to death, and they'd have to wait until spring to dig us out. Of course, in the 990 years of the Trans-Atenate Express's operation, that had never happened. The train had always got through. It was a remarkably secure form of transport, given the terrain it crossed. But there is a first time for anything, as people can be forgiven for thinking. Years of experience warned the train staff to start reassuring and distracting the passengers the moment weather closed in, or they'd have a panic on their hands. The idle rich can be such worriers. We came to a halt four times before dawn the next day. The first time was at about 10 in the evening. The tannoy informed us that we were waiting for wind speeds to ease before crossing the Skarno Gorge Bridge, and that there was no cause for concern. Less than 5 minutes later, we were on our way again. I was still awake at 1 when we gently coasted to a stop again. I felt uneasy, and after 15 minutes tucked the auto-pistol into my belt, strapped Barbarisata to my hip, and covered them both with Amos's long green overrobe. The hallway was dark, the lights dimmed to an auxiliary amber. Little green cue lights glowed on the staff-only monitor display that was set in the panelled wall at the end of the car. I heard someone coming up the spiral stairs from the car's lower deck and turned to see a steward who regarded me quizzically.
"Is everything all right, sir?" he asked.
That was my question. I was wondering why we'd stopped.
It's just routine, sir. We're just coming over the Skarno gradient, and the master engine man has ordered a check of the braking elements in case of excess icing.
I see. Just routine.
Everything's perfectly safe, sir, he said with well-rehearsed assurance.
As if to prove him right, the lights flickered and we were moving again. He smiled.
There we are, sir.
I went back to my cabin. I barely marked the two further stops we made that night. But I kept my weapons to hand. The second full day of travel passed without incident. The weather alternated between long, furious blizzards and quick, glorious episodes of sunlit calm. We stopped 5 more times before supper. 5 more routine hesitations. The Tannoy whispered that though we were behind schedule, we were likely to make up time once we were clear of the mountains and crossing the southern plateau in the latter part of the following day. I was growing impatient. I found myself pacing the train a lot, end to end. I even took Crezia to the salon for lunch and stayed long enough to play a board or two of regicide with her. Medea was gaining strength. By the afternoon, she was sitting up and eating for herself. The cyberskulls disconnected all her drips except the vital monitor. We took turns to sit with her. I let Alina tell her the details of what had happened since the attack on Spaten House. Medea listened intently, increasingly dismayed. When it was my turn to spend an hour at her side, she said,
"You came back for me."
"Yes."
"You might have been killed."
"You would have been."
"They killed Yakud," she said after a pause.
"We were running across the paddocks and they cut him down."
"I know. I felt it."
"I couldn't help him."
"I know."
"I felt terrible, after all he had done to show me my father. And I couldn't save him."
"It was probably quick. The Vessarine are ruthless killers."
"I thought I heard him call out, after he had fallen. I was going to turn back for him, but they were everywhere."
"It's all right." She took a beaker from the bedstand and sipped.
"Elena says they killed everyone."
"I'm afraid they might have."
"I mean, not just here. The distaff, Nail, Inchibel."
I nodded. "Someone was very thorough that night. But here's a thought to cheer you. Nail's alive, and so's Fishig. We're going to meet up with both of them." That made her smile.
"How did Nail get away?"
"I don't know. He hasn't given me any details. It would seem he got wind of something and left Messina before the attack. I'm looking forward to finding out what he knows."
"Like who's behind this, you mean?"
I winked. "That, Medea, I already know." Her eyes widened.
"Who?"
"I'll tell you when I've confirmed my suspicions. I don't want you worrying unnecessarily."
"Now that's just cruel," she scolded. "I won't be able to think about anything else now."
"Then see what you come up with," I suggested. Medea was privy to most of my operation, and I thought it might be interesting to see if she arrived at any conclusion herself. The jolt made me strike my head against the side panel of the bed and woke me up in time to feel 2 more hard judders before the train came to a complete stop. It was nearly 3 in the morning and pitch black. I could hear the ice flakes pattering like small arms fire off the window of the cabin. Every halt we had made so far had been smooth and gentle. Not like this. Amos had woken too, and sat up as I turned on the sidelight and strapped on Barbarisata.
"What is it?"
he asked. "Nothing, I hope." The inter-cabin door opened and Alina looked in.
"Did you feel that?"
she asked sleepily. "Find your pistol," I told her. We woke Crezia and got all 3 of them into Medea's cabin. Crezia looked befuddled and worried. Elena was wide awake by then and checking the cell of her weapon. I pulled on Amos's overrobe to conceal my own armaments. "Stay here and be vigilant," I said, and then left the connecting suite via the door to my cabin. In the gloomy hall, I could hear movement in the other cabins, low voices and the occasional pip of a summoning alarm as worried passengers tried to call the stewards. I went back down the car to the monitor display the moment I saw the 2 red lights shining amongst the green ones. I slid open the display's glass cover and fitted my signet ring to the optical reader. The potent inquisitorial authority codes loaded into my signet ring rapidly overcame Transcontinental Line's confidence software and gave me access to the Express's master system. The monitor's little screen woke up and flickered with user-friendly graphics and bars of data. I requested clarification of the red warning lights. "Alert code 88.508. A systematic trigger of active brake units, cars 7 through 10, forcing main brake arrest. Alert code 521.6911. Irregular breach of door seal, door 34, car 8, lower." I hurried along the upper deck of the train, heading for the rear. Some cabin doors opened and anxious faces looked out. "No need for concern," I called in my best transcontinental tone, backing it up with a gentle surge of will that slammed doors after me like a drum roll. At car 6, I had to go down to the lower deck because of the dining salon. Passing into car 7, I saw 3 train staffers hurrying down the companionway in the direction of car 8. The lower hallway of car 8 was bitterly cold, and a gale was blowing down it. I saw 6 or 7 rail employees pulling on foul weather gear and lighting flares as they jumped down out of the open wagon door into the night. Several more were grouped around the monitor display, and one, a steward, saw me approach.
"Please go back to your cabin, sir. Everything's fine."
"What seems to be the problem?"
"Just hurry back, sir. What's your cabin number? I'll bring along complimentary liqueurs in a few minutes."
"The rear brakes have just thrown and door 34 is open," I said. He blinked.
"How did you?"
"What's going on?"
"Sir, I want to guarantee your comfort, so if you'd just like to..."
I didn't have time for a debate. "What's going on, Inex?" I asked, reading his name off his brass lapel badge and juicing my words with just a touch of will. A name always helped to enhance the mental coercion. He blinked.
"The brake systems in the rear 4 wagons have engaged, which triggered an overall braking incident," he said, quickly and obediently.
"Did someone pull the emergency rope?"
"No, sir. We'd have a source for that. And anyway, the train's entire brake system would have fired simultaneously. We believe it's ice in the aft units."
"That would cause a partial brake lock."
"Yes, sir."
"What about the door?"
"It opened just after we stopped. The chief steward thinks it was one of the engineers opening the door to get out and check the brakes without informing the system he was unlocking the door."
"It wasn't forced?"
"It was opened from inside, with a key."
The effects of my will were ebbing, and his jocular tone returned. "We've got personnel out lineside now, sir, checking the brakes."
"Including this engineer who supposedly opened the door in his eagerness to find the fault?"
"I'm sure, sir."
"Find out," I said, using the will more forcefully. He ran back to the monitor panel, and his colleagues stood back, puzzled, as he operated the device. "Who has access to door keys?"
"Who the hell are you?"
one of the others asked.
"A concerned member of the public," I said, blanketing them all with willpower. "Who has keys?"
"Only engineers of level 2 and higher, class 1 stewards and the guards," said another, stammering in his desperation to tell me.
"How many people is that?"
23.
"Are they all accounted for?"
"I don't know,"
said Inex. "Stand aside," I ordered, and used my ring on the monitor. The train had a staff and crew of 84. Each one had a subdermal tracker implant, so that the trainmaster could account for the location of his people at all times. The display showed a graphic map of the train, but the screen was so small I had to scroll along it, looking at the schematic bit by bit. Master personnel were shown in red, engineers in amber, stewards in green, and guards in blue. Ancillary staff like chefs, waiters, porters, and cleaners were pink. Red and amber dots clustered in the locomotive section, and blue and green ones were speckled throughout the wagons. The upper deck of car 9, the crew quarters, were full of pink lights. I saw a cluster of green and blue cursors that represented the men grouped around me at the back of car 8's lower deck, near door 34. A submenu listed the amber and blue lights that had left the train to inspect the running gear. There was one green light amongst the pink ones in car 9. I called up more information. The green light belonged to Steward Class 1 Rebert Awins. He was in his quarters. The express had made an emergency stop, and all the staff apart from the ancillaries were moving to secure the train, except Awins.
"Awins is Class 1. He'd have keys."
"Yes, sir,"
said Inex. "Why isn't he assisting?" They all looked at each other.
"When did you see him last?"
"He was on the morning shift today," said one of them.
"I saw him in the rec room at shift change having his lunch," added another.
"Since then?"
They shook their heads.
"He should have come on again at 9, said Inex. "Shall I check on him?"
"No," I was going to say, "because he's dead." But there was no point scaring them. I changed my mind.
"Do that, Inex."
I reached over and took the intercom headset off the man nearest me. He didn't protest. He didn't even notice.
"Go to his room and tell me what you find. Vox channel..." I studied the headset's small earpiece and adjusted the responder.
6.
"Yes, sir," said Inex.
As he turned to go, I reached out and touched him briefly on the forehead. He shuddered. My Psi imprint would stay with him for a good 30 minutes now, even once he was out of my vicinity. Inex ran off.
I looked at the car door. It had been pulled too, but the unsecure light was still blinking. There were thawing cakes of dirty ice on the metal deck inside the door. "How many people went out?" I asked. One of them checked the display.
20, sir.
"How many have come back inside since you got here?"
"None," they all said.
They would be looking for me. For us. They knew we were on the train, and they'd got someone aboard at Fonette or La Castra. Someone who had befriended Rebert Awins, killed him, and taken his pass keys. Someone with the technical expertise to trigger a partial brake lock, stop the train, and then use Awin's keys to open an exterior door and let his associates aboard. Someone who, by now, surely knew which cabins we were occupying. I ran back down the train towards Car 3, using the lower deck hallways. I slid Barbarisata from its Nedskin scabbard. It seemed so incongruous to be hurrying down a train's companionway, brandishing a sword. But the cabins around me were full of innocent Imperial citizens, and I didn't dare use my pistol. I also didn't dare use the intercom. I reached out psychically. Elena was an untouchable blank, so I called out to Amos, Crezia, and Medea. "Be ready. Trouble coming." I passed several train staff in the hall as I made my way past, and they jumped back in alarm as they saw the blade. "Forget," I willed at each one as I passed, and they just went on their way. I reached the front end of Car 4 and prepared to go up. A transcontinental steward lay face down on the stairs, his neck snapped. Just then, the frantic voice of Inex wailed into my earpiece.
"He's dead! Oh, God, Emperor, he's dead! Rebert's dead! Sound the alarm!"
The distress klaxon started to warble, and recessed light plates in the wall began to blink orange. I saw a third red light had lit up on the car end monitor panel. I jammed my signet ring against the reader and cued information. Alert code 946.2452. Irregular breach of window seal. Window 146. Car 3. Upper. I clambered over the steward's corpse and made my way up the stairs. The upper hallway of Car 3 was even colder than the chill of Car 8. The end window on the port side, beside the intercarriage articulation, was wide open, and freezing air and snow was whirling in. The window had been cut out of its frame with a power blade or melter torch. The light was bad, gloomy, half-dimmed lamps aggravated by the fretful blink of the alarm lights. The klaxons still whooped. I realized there were three dark shapes halfway down the hall ahead of me, skulking low. They hadn't heard me arrive over the howl of the blizzard and the shrill of the alarms. I hugged the panelled wall. Barbarisata throbbed, hungry. Even passively, I could sense the three men were psi-shielded. They made big silhouettes. Combat armor. I saw the ugly shadow of an assault weapon as the point man waved his partners forward. Forward towards the doors of our compartments. I edged closer. The point man, oozing professionalism as he visually checked his rear, saw me. And all hell broke loose.